This show furnished by Dual Diagnosis Treatment Center.
Welcome to In Your Right Mind, a weekly discussion of behavioral health issues that affect our lives. We all have issues, so let's start talking.
Welcome to In Your Right Mind, a weekly discussion of behavioral health issues that affect our lives. We all have issues, so let's start talking. My name is Stephanie Wilder Taylor.
And I'm Dr. Tanmoy Sharma.
This evening, we're talking about the psychology of a serial killer. How does a serial killer's brain work, and what drives them to kill?
Ted Bundy, Jeffrey Dahmer, Gary Ridgway are only some of the prolific American serial killers. The United States has been home of to some of the worst serial killers in human history.
And there's a lot of interest about this topic these days. There's a lot of shows. A lot of people want to understand what goes on in the mind of a serial killer. And to discuss the psychology of a serial killer, we have a wonderful guest. We have neuroscientist Dr. James Fallon, a professor of psychiatry and human behavior and an emeritus professor of anatomy and neurobiology in the University of California Irvine School of Medicine, and author of the book, The Psychopath Inside.
Welcome to the show, Dr. Fallon, and thank you for joining us this evening.
Well, Tanmoy, Stephanie, glad to be here. Thanks for the invite.
People use the word psychopath in everyday parlance in a much different way than the medical, the neuroscience, and the clinical community use it. For our listeners, perhaps you can make the distinction for them.
Yeah, in a very strict sense, in psychology and psychiatry, psychopathy doesn't exist. Part of it does. It's called antisocial personality disorder that everybody agrees on, all the professionals agree on. One of the problems is the traits of psychopathy everybody accepts and understands. But the question is how you put them together with other traits to come up with some critter, that is, some taxonomy that distinguishes this person from somebody with narcissistic personality disorder or borderline personality disorder. There's several personality disorders that are quite prolific in terms of murder. And very, very bad behavior. And psychopathy is one of them. But there are murderers who don't have personality disorders. Some are schizoaffective, some are schizophrenics, some on the autism spectrum. Some kill because they feel they need to. So the psychopath is a particular type. Most killers are not psychopaths, although they're overrepresented in psychopathy. But there are many psychopaths who never kill, not involved in rape or anything, but they have a number of common traits that are pretty universal around the world in all cultures, including the Inuits. And so it seems to be a very constant sort of thing of about 1% of the population of every culture. It's almost as if nature wants us to have this, and there's some sort of protective mechanism for the species to have these real outliers,
right.
Outliers.
What are some of those traits?
Well, if we break the psychopaths down into, one very handy, good way is there's a primary psychopath. That's what we talk about, a psychopath. Then there's a secondary psychopath, which is the sociopath. The difference between them is that even though they can perform the same behaviors, they can be both murderers and outwardly they look the same, a primary psychopath, the real psychopath, doesn't respond to any punishment or stress or any disapproval at all. And they simply don't care and don't feel that what they're doing is immoral. They know you think it's immoral, but they have no moral reasoning that you would consider, socially acceptable at all. They have their own rules and everything, but it's not what society has. And so they really have no sense of that, and they're quite cold-hearted. And the sociopath, on the other hand, is somebody who understands. They have a moral compass. They do feel remorse when they've done something terrible. They do feel stress. And then these two are broken down into either distempered, raging psychopaths or charismatic psychopaths like some of our leaders, some professionals have. So you would find in walking around everyday society with jobs, people who are primary psychopaths who are also charismatic, and they can navigate their way through life based on what are called positive traits, and these positive pro-social traits. It sounds like such a nice thing, pro-social. They have adaptive skills that allow them to navigate through society and therefore never caught.
Like they've learned to imitate? Is it because they are smart enough to understand what morals are and how people act that have morals, so they sort of imitate it to fit in?
Right, the ones that are smart enough. Now, some are not smart enough. They get caught early and they spend their life in prison usually. But there are smart ones who don't have other damage. And for them, since they don't feel any guilt they don't show any guilt, so they don't have any tells. When they're confronted by a mate, a friend, the police, they don't act guilty at all because, in fact, they don't feel that guilt. And so they have no tells, and people who meet them, police who catch them, he's not stressed out at all. There's no tells, so he's okay. He's in it for the fun, or he's not guilty. Well, this they use to great advantage, and they keep getting away with murder in relationships, in finance, in politics, and at home. So because they don't have, they're not wired to feel stress, anxiety, or when they're caught, or to any sort of moral reasoning, they don't seem to be guilty. That really helps them navigate. And they also tend to seem smarter than they really are, because the part of the brain that gauges social interactions, whether you're hurting somebody else,
right,
whether that's not working. And so normal people, when they interact, have this little loop in the brain that says, okay, I have this feeling, I have this thought. And before they act with the person or say something, they very quickly make this loop that says, am I going to hurt this other person? It's just a matter of morality and sociability.
Right. Dr. Fallon, hang on. I just want to remind our listeners that if they're just tuning in, you're listening to In Your Right Mind with Dr. Tanmoy Sharma. We're talking about the psychology of serial killers with Dr. James Fallon.
Dr. Fallon, we'll come to the neuroscience and the brain scans in a moment. I want to go back a little bit to what you'd said, the charming psychopath. And we associate the word psychopath or even sociopaths with it. There's a negative connotation with it. My question to you is, if you have these psychopathic traits, are they beneficial to you in some career instances, for example?
Yes, high functioning psychopaths, because of their almost universal superficial charm, and they are very confident and tremendous energy too. They have what's called fearless dominance. And fearless dominance is a group of traits that when you walk into a room, you got that light around you. It's charisma. It's Bill Clinton walking through the door and JFK walking through the door. They have this light around them, and people are charmed by it, and they consider it leadership. Now, both those particular presidents have a lot. They're right near the top of the list for psychopathic traits. But we love it. You know, we vote for these people because it seems like leadership. They're very competent, a lot of energy, and they're going to fight for you, you see. And people will do a funny thing. They'll, you know, when they hire somebody or they vote for somebody, it's like, and you see this a lot in Soviet Russia, Eastern Europe, a number of decades ago, where they didn't mind if their leaders did anything really negative or, you know, kind of murderous or cheated on their wives, because they were working for them. You know, it's like, well, he's my guy and he does these awful things, but he's doing it for me. So it's sort of okay. It's sort of probably part of the hypocrisy. Of course, not everybody does.
Well, let me ask you this. If those people who have those traits, these positive leadership traits, are psychopaths, then do they also not have morals and not feel guilt about anything? So couldn't those people also be killers? Or is there a difference?
Well, there could be. But, you know, most psychopaths will say that other psychopaths that have to kill or rape are the losers, right? The other positive symptom pro-social psychopaths are much more clever, and they can get along in the world, really getting their jollies by manipulating the system, manipulating people, getting themselves inserted into very carefully designed parts of, you know, companies, jobs, society, social groups, where they can maximize the control of people. So basically, the most fundamental way of looking at a psychopath is it's an intraspecies predator, a human that's a predator on other humans, but it doesn't necessarily mean murder or rape or anything, just using them and dominating them in some what they consider clever way.
So let's talk about the nonviolent psychopath. The person that, because, you know, everybody talks about murderers, you know, serial killers, etc. But what I'm thinking of is what you said some time ago, that are some of these traits, number one, protective? And secondly, if you had these traits, you know, going up the career ladder and not thinking of the consequences, not having the remorse, does it help certain people go up, either the in politics, in finance, and in terms of ontogeny or in terms of sort of development, if you like, of the species, are these the people that are going to be then leading? Somehow leaders always seem to have some of these traits. So let's talk a little bit about the nonviolent psychopath.
Sure. Now, one thing is we tend to focus on what we clinically a categorical psychopath. And a full categorical psychopath with all the negative traits, too, many of them, is this type of person you're not going to find a CEO of a large organization. You're not going to find – they're really very nasty, and they get caught fairly early in life, right, and as teenagers or in their 20s. But the ones that are not categorical, that is, they don't go over the clinical threshold, like on the hair test of 28 out of 40 points. Mm-hmm. They could be 25s and still be, without being really physically aggressive mm-hmm. or really dangerous that way, they can still be borderline psychopaths. And this is where the large amount of the danger is, because you can find them in positions of power. Often you find them as CEOs in startup companies. Mm-hmm. Smaller companies, but I don't know of many, really, CEOs of large companies, large corporations, are real psychopaths.
This is incredibly interesting. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back and talk more about this. You're listening to In Your Right Mind with Dr. Tanmoy Sharma and our guest, Dr. James Fallon. Be right back.
Are you or a loved one struggling with an addiction as well as a mental health condition? At Sovereign Health, our clinicians target and treat substance use disorders and a variety of mental illnesses concurrently. We provide evidence-based dual diagnosis treatment services for adults and adolescents based on a clinician's customized rehabilitation plan. Call Sovereign Health's dual diagnosis program at 866-325-1801. That's 866-325-1801. Or visit us online at sovhealth.com. Are you concerned that your teen is showing signs of overeating or undereating? At Sovereign Health's Rancho San Diego Adolescent Facility, our clinicians provide thorough assessments and holistic evidence-based treatments for teenage girls who have eating disorders and co-occurring depression, substance abuse, and other mental health issues. Call Sovereign Health today at 866-325-1801. That's 866-325-1801, or visit us online at sovhealth.com. Nearly half of all Americans experience one mental illness at some point in their lives. Sovereign Health offers treatment programs for a large spectrum of issues, including depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, and eating disorders. Call Sovereign Health's dual diagnosis program at 866-325-1801. That's 866-325-1801. Or visit us online at sovhealth.com.
News. Talk. Evolve. 790 KABC.
And we're back with In Your Right Mind with Dr. Tanmoy Sharma. I'm Stephanie Wilder-Taylor. We've been discussing the abnormalities seen in the brains of serial killers with neuroscientist Dr. James H. Fallon, a professor of psychiatry and human behavior and an emeritus professor of anatomy and neurobiology in the University of California Irvine School of Medicine. He's also the author of The Psychopath Inside.
Dr. Fallon, let's talk a little bit about nature versus nurture and the genetic component. Somehow you're born with a certain genetic makeup. And then to what extent does the environment overlay on that? Even if you come from a family that has got a high tendency for psychopathy, you know, you may not display any of this. So tell us a little bit about nature versus nurture.
Well, Tom, everything you said was correct. I can add a couple of points. I mean, this question of nature and nurture goes back to Plato and Aristotle, and it's one of the longest-running, very interesting critical points. But it turns out, there's a little bit of a surprise, that the question itself and the answer are not what we had expected. So if what we know from the last few years of research from the field of epigenetics, which is how environment and genetics interact to really help sculpt who you are, if you look back and you say, for every complex adaptive trait, and it could be aggressiveness and violence, it could be empathy, it could be fear, there's a whole bunch, about 350 complex adaptive traits, and they all are regulated by about 15, 10 to 20 major genes. And there are other regulators involved. So when we talk of something like the control of aggression or violence, we talk of a warrior gene. It's really, there's 15 major warrior genes. And this seems important because there's so many genes that control it that you're bound to inherit from your mother and father the alleles of that gene, which may either be for aggression, maybe a high aggression related allele, that is a form of the gene, or low aggression. If you have both parents who have high aggression forms of allele, you're going to probably be very competitive, aggressive person. Doesn't make you a killer, psychopath, but the trait of aggressiveness, which you do find in psychopaths, and in normal people, you're probably going to have that. But most people are a mix, so most people are normal. That is, they have a mix of these alleles that control these behaviors. Now, if you look at all of these traits, well, you add these traits up, they're on a spectrum, each one of them, and if you score at a certain point, a certain threshold, then you can be said to be a clinical narcissistic, personality disorder, or psychopath. But if you go back to each of the traits, the way these interact together, if you say nature and nurture, they seem to maybe be 50-50, and the answer is not really. And here is the big surprise of what we found in the past few years, is that in some people, the environment, it means everything. But in some other people, it means nothing. So you get these kids that, you know, can fall apart if you just look at them funny. You know, they're very susceptible to stress, very susceptible, or very resistant. And there are other people, you know, fall down the stairs, kids, and they come up laughing. And we know, just, you know, if you've been a parent or an aunt or an uncle, but you know that, yeah, from one family, you can have these kids that are very resistant. So they have these resilience genes, right? If you're born with a lot of resilience genes to these particular traits that are involved in personality disorders, like emotional empathy, like aggression, like manipulating others, short temper, risk taking, etc. If you have the resilience genes, then almost nothing will affect it in the environment. Just grow up as you kind of were when you were born. You know, it's a thing, if you ask parents, because every parent, every government, every religion, they want to say, well, I'm going to shape this kid according to the way I am. And of course, it very rarely turns out that way. You can screw up a kid by abusing them or banning them, but they're basically who they are for most kids.
I want to remind our audience that if they're just tuning in, you're listening to In Your Right Mind with Dr. Tanmoy Sharma, and we're talking about psychopathy with Dr. James Fallon. And what about kids, let's just say, I've heard a lot about Ted Bundy and how his childhood, he says, was just fine. Loving home. So how do we, is that then pure genetics? Are some people just born with the bad kind of psychopathy?
He just made that up. Many psychopaths manipulate the legal system, manipulate the public. His upbringing was terrible. You know, his probable father was his grandfather. His mother gave birth to him up in Vermont. Was at a home for unwed mothers, and he was abused terribly. But when he talked about it, he talked about it wasn't that, it was everything's hunky-dory. He's manipulating people. But everything we know about him, he had a terrible childhood. And the family was abusive to the point when, you know, when your own grandfather is your father, I mean, something's wrong. And you find that, you know, even the question about Putin may have made up his whole childhood. A number of people who know him said he had a terrible childhood, but he said it was very normal. And so you find this a lot. These kids, they're protecting their tormentors, but they can also be just manipulating the system.
But are there kids, because I feel like I know of cases where there are kids that say come from loving homes, and they're just from a really young age, there's something different about them. Is that a thing, or is that a different kind of personality disorder? Are there some kids that are just born with a bad gene? Are there bad seeds?
Well, there's no bad or good genes, but they can be triggered in a bad way. And if you got enough of the alleles that control these behaviors, that is, you've really inherited in this casino of genetics that you've inherited a lot of high-risk alleles. Well, if you're not abused or abandoned early on, most susceptible period is birth to about 3 years old. If you're not, then you have these traits, but you may end up just being extremely aggressive, but not have a personality disorder. And there's very difference between a narcissist and somebody with narcissistic personality disorder. The ones with personality disorders think what they're doing is fine, and they don't even recognize it as a problem. Whereas people just with the trait know what they're doing, know what they're feeling and thinking is incorrect. So you can get a kid came from a good family who may be, and you don't always know if they were abused, right? A lot of times it's a hidden abuse, so you don't know. All the murders and that I've looked at, and pedophiles, they all had terrible abuse, terrible childhoods very early on. Now, you can still be sociopathic. That is, you can grow up in a family, but then later on, where you get bullied when you're 8, 9, 10, this is where you tend to get the sociopath, who may not be genetically or epigenetically set or triggered to have this traits forever as personality disorder, but they are intent on getting even, and they're going to get even. Like a fair number of terrorists will be like this. They're not psychopaths, although the leaders of these groups may be psychopaths, but they are getting even with the world. They feel like losers, etc., and that is not the same as being like a categorical clinical psychopath. The psychopaths are very cold. They don't think what they're doing is wrong. That's different than somebody with the same behavior who knows what they're doing is wrong. And so you have to know what's called the intermediate phenotype, really what's going on in their brain to really separate these two out, because the behaviors can be the same.
Right.
But the critter inside may be quite different.
Right. Dr. Sharma?
Yeah. Dr. Phelan, let's talk a little bit about brain imaging. And tell us a story about your study of Alzheimer's and finding brain scans that were similar.
Well, in my own personal case, I mean, I always consider myself a regular guy. I mean, you know, I grew up a regular guy. I was in sports and was a laborer and a truck driver. I still have my Teamsters card. And I became a scientist, but I grew up as really a regular guy and never thought there was anything wrong with me. And approaching my retirement, we were doing a study. And I finished looking at this whole group of murderers and categorizing them. And that was back in 2005, 2006. And at the same time, I was looking at all these murderer scans and I'd seen the pattern, what seems to be the underlying pattern in all psychopathic killers, too. While I was doing that, we had another study going on, because we usually are doing multiple studies. We do a lot of schizophrenia studies, addiction studies, but we also had an Alzheimer's study, and we were doing PET scans, just like we were doing with the murderers. But we were doing PET scans and genetics on Alzheimer's patients. We were looking for the gene, in addition to ApoE, that would contribute to Alzheimer's. There seemed to be something missing. In the study, we found it. It's called TOM40. But at any rate, in the study, we had finished the study with all of our patients, but we needed controls. So I had the really stupid idea of getting myself and my family involved, because I knew we could go in there in that two-week period and get scans and genetics done, you know, to finish the study up. And so I did my family, myself, and my brothers and sisters came in, my kids. And at the end of this study, we were looking at all the Alzheimer's patients and the normals. The technicians in our lab brought in these scans. I was sitting at the desk, and I had the whole pile of murderer scans on one side, and they plopped down these scans of the Alzheimer's patients. And in this case, it was my family. I told them to cover up. Don't leave the names on, because I didn't know who was who. I wanted to do this blindly, you know, like any scientist would. And I was flipped through these scans of my family just to quickly see if there's any gross abnormalities. And I got through the first eight, and I said, oh, my God, this is great, because they all look quite normal. So, and this was important because my wife's family, there was all this Alzheimer's, so we were concerned that she might, you know, have the markers and the genetics. But she was quite brave about this, and she went ahead with this to have it done. Well, as I got to the bottom of the pile, and I looked at the scan, and then I looked at my technicians. I said, very funny. You know, sometimes in laboratories, people tease each other and screw around like anybody. And I said, okay, you switch the scan. This is very funny. This is one of the psychopaths. This is a pretty bad psychopath, and whoever it is should not be walking around in open society. And I said, very funny. And they go, no. They said, that's one of your family. I said, you got to be kidding me.
Oh, my God.
And so I had to kind of protect society. You figure one of my brothers or something, my mother or my wife, a psychopath. So I peeled it back, and there was my name. And it was one of those moments, because I never had thought myself to be a psychopath. But here it was. And all I just laughed when I saw it, because I kind of got the joke, you know, okay, it's a joke and it's on me. But I immediately did what any scientist would do. I assumed that my theory was wrong, you know. And so I assumed it was wrong, and they went and checked the scanner and checked the computer, and they said, no, it's true. But it turns out that other people in the following 3 or 4 years came up with studies on psychopaths and got the same results. So that my theory was not wrong. In fact, the pattern of my brain in a PET scanner is really fully psychopathic.
I'm so sorry. We have to take a break, but we're going to be back with you for two more segments. And we're going to be bringing in our next segment, Dr. Catherine Ramsland, to talk about what goes on inside the criminal mind, including Dr. James Fallon's criminal mind, turns out. Okay, we will be right back with In Your Right Mind, hosted by Sovereign Health with Dr. Tanmoy Sharma.
Are you tired of struggling with addiction? Sovereign Health's Prime program aims to help men over 40 transition from chemical dependency to a state of lasting recovery in an environment suited to their age and specific needs. Let us help you get your life back on track. It's never too late. Call Sovereign Health today at 866-325-1801. That's 866-325-1801. Or visit us online at sovhealth.com. Are you or a loved one experiencing bouts of emotional overeating or undereating? These can be symptoms of an eating disorder. At Sovereign Health, we believe that these brain diseases that strain people's lives should not define them. Call Sovereign Health today at 866-325-1801. That's 866-325-1801. Or visit us online at sovhealth.com. Find a better way to live a better life at Sovereign Health. Nearly half of all Americans experience at least one mental illness at some point in their lives. Sovereign Health offers a residential treatment program for a large spectrum of issues, including depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, post-traumatic stress disorder, and eating disorders. Call Sovereign Health today at 866-325-1801. That's 866-325-1801. Or visit us online at sovhealth.com.
Talk Radio 790, KABC News Update, I'm Steve Cumming. Thousands of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School students and their parents were able to pick up book bags and other belongings left behind after the shooting massacre that left 17 dead. Student Marcel Oliveira described the experience.
I felt happy to be back, to be around everybody that was there, to know that everybody was safe. It was uplifting. I felt better.
Parts of the Midwest are recovering after being battered by severe storms. One Kentucky resident says he saw the warning signs of the tornado before it touched down.
Looked outside and started seeing the trees start bowing. And right about that time, I all of a sudden felt the pressure on the window.
Storm crews have confirmed an EF2 tornado struck in south central Kentucky yesterday, where a woman died at her home. KABC SoCal weather tonight mostly clear with lows in the lower to mid 40s. More news coming up and continuous coverage on KABC.com. I'm Steve Cumming, Talk Radio 790, KABC News.
We are back with In Your Right Mind with Dr. Tanmoy Sharma. I'm Stephanie Wilder-Taylor. We've been discussing psychopathy with Dr. James Fallon, professor of psychiatry, and we're going to be joined right now by Dr. Catherine Ramsland, a professor of forensic psychology at DeSales University in Pennsylvania, who's published over 1,000 articles and 63 books, including Confession of a Serial Killer, The Untold Story of Dennis Rader, the BTK Killer. So let's turn our attention to what goes on inside the mind of a serial killer.
Dr. Ramsland, welcome to the show. Our audience is a lay one. It would be wise to talk about the psychology, if you like, of a serial killer. And how does somebody get to be that aggressive and the repeated nature of the violent acts?
Well, it's not possible to generalize about all serial killers because they all have their own developmental trajectory toward becoming one. Some can become serial killers at a young age in their teens. Others, in fact, we even have a couple of 8-year-olds who are serial killers or later in life. And some are motivated sexually, some are motivated by greed, some by anger. There are so many different aspects of serial murder because a serial killer is not actually a criminal type.
Right.
It's simply a description of a behavior of having at least two victims in two separate incidents, according to the FBI's definition. So
right.
It's hard to say, unless you're talking about a specific individual,
right,
what makes someone a serial killer.
But in terms of
their repeating the act, often, especially if it's sexually compelled, it's an addictive kind of quality.
Can you go back to, I'm fascinated by, there were 8-year-old serial killers?
Yeah, I've heard of two.
Do you think that's environmental? Do you think that's something that goes very awry in their upbringing? Or is that somebody whose has a genetic disposition to that kind
it's
of antisocial behavior?
There is no formula for making a distinction between how much weight someone's physiology might have versus their environment, because a lot of it comes down to their perception and reaction to things.
Mm-hmm.
So different people can have a similar brain design, as I'm sure you've already heard about, but have a very different sense of their life experience and what they're going to do about it. So there's really no formula for nature versus nurture. It's different for each individual. One was in India and one was, I think, in Peru. Both of them were male. One killed three babies in the course of a year. And I don't remember what the other one was, but we also have a 10-year-old girl who killed two different boys. That was Mary Bell in England.
I heard about that one.
And you do, I mean, we can look at her case and see the horrendous way her mother treated her and what she was subjected to. We don't know that she has the brain of a psychopath by any means, and probably she doesn't, because she did get out of prison eventually and raise a family and probably does not have what people were saying of her at the time, that she was a bad seed, she was a born criminal. I think that had a lot to do with her environment. So it's not, we just don't have a formula for saying how much is nature and how much is nurture.
So how is the sequential predatory behavior developed through the key elements like imagination, symbolism, etc.? Are there stages?
The first thing is, what's their motivation? Because if their motivation is simply, you know, greed, and they just want to enrich themselves, there wouldn't be the same kind of developmental repetitiveness as if it were something in their fantasy life.
Mm-hmm.
So what kind of predatory activity are they actually doing is the first question to ask. And because some are serial killers simply because they're angry and punitive and they want to hurt people. That doesn't have the same addictive quality as a sexually based fantasy life that spins out serial murder.
Right. And so can killing become an addiction?
Killing can become an addiction, but not all serial killers who are killing are doing it because they're addicted to murder. Some want to eliminate witnesses. They're addicted to something else about it, or they're addicted to the torture of it. So, killing itself can certainly become an addiction.
And in terms of do you have a subcategory of people where they can't really help themselves but kill?
Before you answer that, I just want to remind our listeners that if they're just tuning in, you're listening to In Your Right Mind with Dr. Tanmoy Sharma, and we're discussing what characteristics set serial killers apart from other violent murderers with Dr. Catherine Ramsland, a forensic psychology professor at DeSales University. And we also have on the line Dr. James Fallon. Go on.
I think the question was, is there anybody who can't help but kill? Well, again, it's to some extent their perception of what they can't help. Dennis Rader, for example, who I worked with for 5 years, would say that killing was when he felt most alive, even mm-hmm. though he had all these other aspects of his life. He was married, he was active in his church, he had a job. The actual murder was when he felt most attuned with himself and most powerful. So he might say, I can't help but kill, but, you know, in fact, he could help it. He just didn't want to.
But some people feel alive when they go to the gym, you know, so obviously that person though has to be a psychopath, right? Because they know that killing is wrong, yet they don't have any kind of guilt about taking somebody's life. They're more interested in them feeling alive. Correct?
Well, we have a lot of killers who don't classify as psychopaths. If you use the psychopathy checklist that Robert Hare developed,
mm-hmm.
Not all people who murder and have no remorse over it would necessarily qualify as psychopaths. So mm-hmm. that's the first thing.
Mm-hmm.
But some, like, I think Mary Bell is a good example in fact, because at the time when she was 10 and 11 years old and she murdered two young boys and mutilated one, she did say she didn't feel any remorse. In fact, when they brought one out of his house after the viewing, she was clamping her hands and having a great time over it. But now, in retrospect, she when they interviewed her, she's horrified at what she did. So would she qualify as a psychopath? Not at all.
But what's the difference? Can you explain to me the difference? Because Dr. Fallon, and weigh in if you please, but you said a psychopathy is the lack of any kind of remorse, right? And yet you can be and killing seems the ultimate thing to do if you have no remorse and no feelings of empathy. But what would another, how can you tell the difference then of somebody who's a psychopath and somebody who's not, if they're both committing a crime and having no remorse?
Well, there's a clinical checklist, and I think what they're referring to is Robert Hare's checklist, that people, it is possible to be a serial killer as defined by the FBI or to do repeated killings without necessarily achieving that clinical threshold.
Exactly.
In Robert Hare's checklist, because it's a very specific checklist, and you may have some of the qualities, and you may, and I think Dr. Fallon had said this in the previous segment, that there was, that you may be sub-threshold and still be prone to killing or to murder, whatever it is. So it's not necessary. Psychopaths can be serial killers. It's not necessary that serial killers have to be psychopaths. So
nor are most psychopaths criminals.
Right. Right. So Dr. Fallon, it's an interesting juncture. Do you want to jump in?
Well, I agree with Catherine, what she said. I'm being quiet because I don't disagree with her.
Yeah, no.
One point is that people think that you can use scanning, fMRI or PET scan,
yes,
or the genetics to determine if somebody is a killer or a psychopath, and you can't.
No.
And I'm really against it, but what you see, the implied circuitry that you see from a functional scan like fMRI or positron emission tomography, they do line up with traits. So if you're given, like a neuroanatomist is given the scans, they'll say, well, this person probably has trouble with their language, this person probably has very little problem with violence. Doesn't make them a categorical psychopath or anything. So that has to be done by a very experienced psychologist or psychiatrist who really is adept in personality disorders. That's who determines whether the person is a psychopath or not. Now, if you want to dig in below what you see, their behavior, that is their, what's called the phenotype, why are they doing that? That's when the scans together with the genetics can really help you say, well, how is this behavior coming about? So you don't answer the question, is this person a killer? Is this person a psychopath? But once that's been established, it's very useful with the biological markers, that is the brain anatomy and the genetics.
I am learning a lot right now. We unfortunately have to take one more break, but when we come back, we'll be finishing our discussion on the psychology of serial killers with Dr. Catherine Ramsland, Dr. James Fallon, Dr. Tanmoy Sharma, and me, Stephanie Wilder-Taylor. You're listening to In Your Right Mind, brought to you by Sovereign Health. We'll be right back.
Are you tired of struggling with addiction? Sovereign Health's Power Program utilizes evidence-based interventions tailored to women over 40 to help them develop tools necessary for lasting recovery. Power specializes in treating substance abuse disorders and other underlying mental health issues, including trauma, anxiety, and depression. Recover with Power. Call Sovereign Health today at 866-325-1801. That's 866-325-1801. Or visit us online at sovhealth.com. At Sovereign Health, we understand that the Christian faith is an integral part of recovery. If you're suffering from an addiction or mental illness, let us help you heal with others who share your beliefs and values. Call Sovereign Health today at 866-325-1801. That's 866-325-1801. Or visit us online at sovhealth.com. Start your new life today. Sovereign Health's adolescent program offers treatment for males and females ages 12 to 17 struggling with addiction, mental health, and co-occurring conditions. Let us help you and your family heal in a safe, nurturing environment with an individualized treatment plan that has your loved one's treatment needs in mind. Call Sovereign Health today at 866-325-1801. That's 866-325-1801. 1801 or visit us online at sovhealth.com.
The thought of my sons growing up without me inspired me to quit smoking.
I talked to my doctors and then I threw away all my cigarettes, ashtrays, and lighters.
I started exercising instead of smoking.
Getting support from friends online kept me on track.
Staying away from alcohol when I was first quitting was key.
Instead of smoking after I ate, I'd get up and take a walk.
I missed having a cigarette in my hand, so I'd hold a pen or a straw, anything.
Until I knew I wouldn't give in to temptation, I spent more time with my friends who didn't smoke.
I went to places that were smoke-free.
I didn't stay quit the very first time I tried.
I kept on trying, and I learned something each time.
Do whatever it takes.
No matter how many times it takes.
I quit.
I quit.
I quit.
We did it, so can you.
You can quit. For free help, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and CDC.
It's coming, 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 coming back. Starting March 5th, keep it here for more details. 790-KABC.
Previously on The Drive Home.
Boy, having kids, just, you're so lucky you don't have any. And I'll say this, I mean it like this. All I do is worry about them. School shootings, I worry. Outbreaks, hepatitis, meningitis, I worry. Worry, 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 worry. You parents know what I'm talking about. It's a nightmare. My friends that don't have any, just keep on keeping on.
I love you, Mommy.
The Drive Home. With Jillian Barber and John Phillips.
Weekdays 3 to 6.
On Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Talk Radio 790
KABC.
And we are back with In Your Right Mind with Dr. Tanmoy Sharma. I'm Stephanie Wilder-Taylor. We've been discussing the psychology of serial killers with Dr. Catherine Ramsland and Dr. James Fallon.
Dr. Ramsland, before the break, you mentioned about the lack of correlation between psychopathy and criminality, if you like. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Psychopathy, if we look at the psychopathy checklist scale, is 20 behaviors and traits that a person is measured in terms of how much they manifest it from 0 to 2, and then they get a score on that scale. And many of them, like, they may be manipulative, deceptive, have serial relationships, be parasitic and whatnot, but it doesn't make them criminals, and certainly not necessarily violent. In fact, the most successful psychopaths are, they typically will go into business or politics or banking because they're looking to enrich themselves. They don't like theme boards. They're looking for high excitement types of arenas. They're not wanting to be caught. In fact, most of the criminal psychopaths we're looking at are the lower functioning psychopaths, or might have some other kind of issue with their brain or physiology. Most psychopaths are not criminal and certainly are not serial killers. But the reason we think so is probably media oriented. The media fixates on psychopaths being the ultimate evil. And so inevitably, if you think that, you're going to equate the ultimate evil person with a serial killer.
Well, in talking about serial killers, though, and say Mary Bell, if she wasn't a psychopath, what was she then?
She was a child who's exposed to terrible circumstances, abuse of all kinds, in an arena where she did not learn to have pro-social behaviors. She acted out, and then the course of her life in prison learned to become more pro-social. But she didn't have a chance when she was a young girl. She was just acting out in a way that she was observing around her.
But we rarely see, especially kids, right, murder people. So, and tons of children are abused or have negative experiences in their childhood. So do you think that there's some correlation with something going on, some personality disorder or something different about their brain that would allow somebody that young to kill?
And I talk about a lot about this in my classes. It really has a lot to do with the particular way a specific individual perceives their world processes the information to which they're exposed and reacts to it, because yes, a lot of kids are abused and they don't become abusers, but those who do become abusers will have a certain set of circumstances as well as a sense of their world, whether it's safe or unsafe, whether even they can trust themselves, whether they trust other people, that will have something to do with it. And also if they have some kind of brain involvement, but it's very individual. It's really difficult to make a generalization without really seeing the details of a particular case.
If you look at all the traits, there's probably an almost infinite number of ways that you can be a psychopath or, let's say, a narcissist. And it's true also for schizophrenia and other disorders. So there's a whole spectrum of them and many types. But if you look at brain development in childhood, imagine a two-year-old that weighs 220 pounds. You know, in the first article I wrote years ago on psychopathy, one of my chapters was two-year-old granddaughter is a psychopath, meaning that there are these traits of not caring, and it's like, I want that, I'm just going to get it. You can almost make it seem that way. And one way to look at it, even though they're not psychopaths, but the traits are reminiscent of it. Partially, none of these behaviors by themselves are evil or bad. That is, it's perfectly okay to kill somebody if they're attacking your family. It's not like murder is categorically evil. It depends on the context. Same with sex. You know, we have social context. Well, you know, a lot of the drives in the brain that have to do with aggression, predation, eating, drinking, sex, all of that good stuff is processed in a distributed system. At its center is the amygdala, which is the temporal lobe. Well, in psychopaths, this thing is not turned on by normal sorts of stimuli. And so if you show a normal person something violent, and you do a PET scan or fMRI, that will really activate that whole system with disgust, revulsion. If you show the same thing, a burning school bus of children, to a psychopath, it's almost as if they're looking at a group of roses or a puppy dog. It doesn't activate. So they can see it, but it doesn't activate it in the same way in terms of that processing. Now, the break on this is the orbital cortex, the ventromedial cortex, which is the cortex in the frontal lobe above the eyes. That is kind of a break on the amygdala, and they talk to each other. In psychopaths, that pathway is partially gone, so they're not talking to each other. So the social and moral context of what the amygdala wants you to do, a lot of times the amygdala wins, but in psychopaths, that is broken, and you don't have contextually social, what we consider moral behavior.
If you're just tuning in, you are listening to In Your Right Mind with Dr. Tanmoy Sharma. We're having a fascinating discussion about the characteristics of serial killers and the difference between psychopaths and just regular people who kill with Dr. James Fallon and Dr. Catherine Ramsland.
Can serial killers lead, quote-unquote, normal lives? Can they be completely part of society? You know, what am I thinking of, Mr. and Mrs. Smith? The Brad Pitt movie, that they are part of a community and yet they might be killers, and that there's very little to distinguish them otherwise.
We have quite a few people like that, actually. Colonel Russell Williams, for example, was in charge of the second largest Air Force base in Canada. He was the one who would fly the Queen around, and at the same time he was breaking into homes, stealing all kinds of underwear from women, and then became a serial killer. He was married, seemed normal to people. His best friend was stunned. Dennis Rader, another one, he was the head, the president of his church council. He had a wife and two children. His daughter right now is writing a book about just how difficult it is to realize that this man that was a really good father to her could have possibly been a serial killer. So,
Catherine, if we take this outside of, can normal people partition their lives? So you can see regular normal people who are having, like, non-ending affairs with, you know, they're married and they're having affairs. Right. That's not criminal. But they will partition that behavior, and everything else they do in their life is good. They're in charities and everything. Mm-hmm. And so the average person, I think, can look at their own life and say, how do I partition my own bad behavior? So it goes within that. I think it's normal just to have 95% of your life look normal to the outside world. And even if you're not killing anybody or raping or doing that, you could have a pretty funky life that you're covering up.
Are there any tells so that we might have a hint that our husband is leading a double life, or that our church, the head of our church, is stealing underwear on the side? Is there any way we can tell?
I'm telling you, when Dennis Rader was arrested and was confessing, there were people coming to the police station saying, you have the wrong man. You are completely wrong on this. His minister came, his wife, his brothers. They all thought the police were completely wrong as Rader was actually confessing to 10 murders. It's very difficult. I mean, you can look at some people who might be psychotic, and so their behavior is out of control, and maybe they have an aggressive impulse. So, okay, those are identifiable. But a serial killer who wants to operate in what Dr. Fallon just said, partitioned or compartmentalized way, Rader calls it cubing, they are very adept at keeping it secret because they do not want you to figure it out. They want to keep doing what they're doing.
Okay, so before we have to go, which is in a couple minutes, can these people get better? Can somebody who's a serial killer learn that that's wrong and develop empathy and stop killing people?
And if they're not psychotic, for example, I just want to clarify this. We are not talking about people killing because of their psychosis. These are people who just have antisocial personality disorder.
Right, right.
Can we treat them? Can they be rehabilitated?
Well, there's a very good program right now in Wisconsin, the Mendota program, and they're dealing with juveniles who are at risk for becoming psychopaths. It's very intensive and expensive therapy, but they are actually having very good results with it. It doesn't make a person not a psychopath, but it does teach them their own best interests are to rein in some of the things that they want to do and to learn, at least act out pro-social behavior. And that program is actually seeing real success with these kids. It has to be done early, though. I mean, you're not going to get adults.
It's a bit like with addictions. Everybody, if they really try every day, can beat an addiction. But every day they have to control themselves willfully, whether any sort of addiction. And you can have good behavior, but you let it go and you slip right back into that pattern. So I have never seen anybody really for any length of time. You know, it's like losing weight. You know, people go on diets for a couple of months and they always snap back the next year. Almost everybody does, except maybe 5%. You have to see good evidence that you can reverse this in a long-term way. When they get into prison, if they've done really something awful, they come out in the next 2 weeks, they're doing the same stuff. So I am very skeptical whether you can reverse this because it's hardwiring. These are myelinated, hardwired tracts that are formed early in your youth. And it's not like these other very plastic pathways like that we treat for schizophrenia and other things with like dopamine, serotonin. Those are unmyelinated fibers and they're plastic. These personality disorders seem to be really wired in hard. So, you know, we all are dying for this to work, some of these techniques, but it's yet to show any permanence.
Well, so much for ending on a cheery note. Unfortunately, that is all the time that we have. We need to do a whole another show on this, Dr. Sharma. Yeah. You see,
yes.
I'm fascinated.
We're not being recorded.
No, we still are. I want to thank you guys so much. Dr. Fallon, where can we find you and your work?
Like tomorrow, I live on the UC Irvine campus. We're the first or third family here, so I'm almost like a potted plant here.
Okay.
So I do my research. Yeah. And even though I'm partially retired, and I'm still involved in research, and we meet at my house here
okay.
on campus. So.
All right. Well, Dr. Ramsland, where can we find your books?
Well, my books are and really everywhere, Amazon. I'm on Facebook. I'm very active there. I write a blog for Psychology Today that I post a lot on too.
Wonderful, wonderful. Okay, well, I want to thank you guys both and thank everybody for listening. And don't forget to tune in next Sunday at 5 p.m. for an all-new episode of In Your Right Mind. And if you like what you hear, you can download this edition of In Your Right Mind as a podcast on iTunes or visit inyourrightmind.com to hear this show or previous broadcasts. See you next week.
Good night.
This show furnished by Dual Diagnosis Treatment Center.
I'm Tiffany.